From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mexico's drug war, 50,000 dead since 2006, rages atop a huge drug trade. Billions a year in cocaine, marijuana, heroin, and methamphetamines to the United States. It's created a vast, powerful, violent drug business. The man at the top of the biggest cartel is El Chapo, with an operation, says my guest today, to rival UPS or Amazon. This hour On Point, the business side, the personal side of Mexico's multi-billion dollar drug trade inside Mexico's Sinaloa cartel and the drug world of its chief, El Chapo. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know about the war next door? The Mexican drug trade, are you the end customer? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just listen to the news. You can hear it any time. The big killings in Mexico, piles of bodies found beheaded. And in the United States, seizures. Here's just one. From last February, federal drug enforcement officers seizing millions of dollars and lots of Mexican cartel drugs in Atlanta. Fox Atlanta reporter Portia Bruner had the scoop there.
DEA agents say the drugs, the cash, all the other assets seized during this two-year investigation, they're all proof that Atlanta is still a major hub for the Mexican drug cartel. Special Agent Rodney Benson says their investigation, dubbed Operation Four Horsemen, resulted in the seizure of $23.8 million and 567 kilograms of cocaine.
A lot of money, a lot of drugs, and it's only a tiny, tiny fraction of what runs out there. Joining us now from Washington is Patrick Radden Keefe, staff writer for the New York and fellow at the Century Foundation. His cover piece for the New York Times Magazine last weekend was Cocaine, How the World's Most Powerful Drug Traffickers Run Their Business. Patrick, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You say cocaine, but it's really a lot more than that, as you report there. I mean, it's right across the big drug menu. They're basically running it all.
They are, yes. Sinaloa is the only one of the big Mexican cartels that's sort of fully diversified in terms of the products it offers. So it originally was in the business of heroin and marijuana, and then moved into the business of cocaine in a big way during the 80s. And also now in the last 10 years or so has been moving a lot of methamphetamine as well, producing it and moving it.
You want it, they've got it. We're going to look at how that works. And the leader of the whole thing, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, you call him a quasi-mythical figure in Mexico. What do you mean by that, Patrick?
Well, he's been in the business for a long time. I mean, generally with these narcos, their careers and indeed their lives don't last very long. But as I say a little flippantly in the piece, when Pablo Escobar was Chapo's age, he'd been dead for a decade.
Guzman is 55. You say that's about 150 in narco years.
Right, exactly. They tend not to make it to that ripe old age. So he's been in the business for a long time. He's kind of defied efforts by his adversaries and his competitors and also law enforcement to capture him. And he's just a mysterious figure. There are only about, there are fewer than half a dozen photos of him in existence. And they're spaced out over the years, so it's hard to know exactly what he looks like. There are reports, reports and stories about him, you know, sweeping into town, going into some restaurant with his big entourage, confiscating everybody's cell phones, eating his dinner, you know, sort of sitting there dining on fist-sized shrimp, having a lavish dinner, and then picking up the tab for everybody and leaving. These kinds of stories have a lot of currency in Mexico, and there are dozens of these narco ballads, narco corridos, about Chapo and his exploits.
We will hear some of those in this hour. And here he is, sitting in the restaurant, picking up the tab, but then he can afford to do it. You say his cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, one of the handful in Mexico, is responsible itself for as much as half of all the illegal narcotics imported into the United States from Mexico every year. That just sounds unbelievable.
It does, but they've been expanding their market share pretty violently in recent years. And so most of the estimates that you hear are between 40 and maybe even up to 60% of all the drugs that come in.
Give us a sense of the scale. What does that mean in terms of, trucks full, trains full, planes full? It's hard to get our head around the scale of drug volume you're describing.
All of the above, yeah. I mean, it's really an industrial process, and I think part of the reason I wrote the piece was to try and underline that I think we lose sight of this as a huge consumer industry, feeding demand day in, day out, year in, year out. And so they're moving just massive volumes across the border at any time, and in some instances also producing the drugs here to be closer to market.
You talk about a logistical network that is as sophisticated in some ways, you write, Patrick, as that of Amazon, as in Amazon.com or UPS. Begin to paint a picture of that for us.
Well, I mean, what I should say, first of all, just as a caveat up top, is that all the numbers in this relating to this industry are garbage numbers. Any number you hear, you should be highly skeptical.
But you're taking the low ones, and they.
But I'm taking the low ones, right? So if you take the outer estimates, the Department of Justice estimates that the Mexican and Colombian cartels reap $18 to $39 billion a year from drug sales in the United States. The United Nations, if you actually crunch their numbers, it's even higher. It could be up to $60 billion. But if you take the really low number, the lowest kind of respectable number you'll see out there, or quasi-respectable, is from the RAND Corporation. They say that in total, in revenue, the Mexican cartels only reap about $6.6 billion. Coming into the U.S. But if you then crunch on the math and you figure that Sinaloa has 40 or 50% of that, this is a huge business. I mean, this is a business potentially with $3 billion in annual revenue, and that's if you take the very lowest available numbers.
It pays for a lot of logistics. It pays for a lot of guns and violence. It pays for a lot of corruption. We'll look at all that. Who is this man sitting behind it, 55 years old, Joaquin Guzman? Who is he? Where did he come from?
So he came from the mountains. He had a kind of rough rural upbringing in Sinaloa, which is a state in northwest Mexico. That I say in the piece, it's a little bit like the Sicily of Mexico.
It's hot, remote. Blasted, dry, remote, not much industry until
right.
this.
Unruly, very rural. And many of the leaders, many of the famous drug cartel leaders over the years have actually come from Sinaloa, even those who ended up in other parts of Mexico. It's a place where many of these people trace their origins. He grew up in this environment. He was in school, I think, through the third grade. Mm-hmm. He is widely believed to struggle with reading and writing.
Dyslexia or something, or maybe just illiteracy.
It may be just illiteracy. Mm-hmm. I did interview one person who had met him and says that he actually speaks a little bit of English, but it's not clear how well he reads. At one point, he actually had a ghostwriter pen letters to his mistress, pen love letters for him. Kind of an interesting...
Hard for him to do, maybe easier for the ghostwriter. That can mean all kinds of things. You described a testimony before one jury where a confidant describes him as driven, obsessive entrepreneur with a urge toward micromanagement of this very big operation.
Yeah, this was one of the things that was quite surprising to me, was that there were some senses in which, as I sort of tried to sketch out Chapo Guzman as a person a little bit, he seemed like any other corporate magnate. This is something that wasn't in the piece, but he doesn't make and take his own calls. There's a woman who's known within the cartel just as the voice. And she's the person who is kind of his interface with the outside world. Things like that that you would in some ways think would be typical of a Warren Buffett or a Bill Gates. There were other senses, though, in which he actually seems even now to really micromanage the business. He'll get on the phone and negotiate deals and negotiate, you know, exactly what the price per kilo of heroin is going to be, and what have you. And talking to people and seeing some of the testimony from people in some instances quite high up in the cartel, I think he loves the deal. You do get the sense that this is we may be at a point where he's not even doing this for the money.
Just empire building. I mean, we know that from other great empire builders in business and beyond. His nickname means shorty, and he is. El Chapo, you describe him kind of rocking up on the balls of his feet in meetings. He may be a CEO type, but he's also a drug lord and can be very intimidatingly intense despite his short stature.
Yes, and I mean, on top of that, a very violent guy. I mean, in doing this investigation, one of the things I wanted to do was was correct what I perceived as a little bit of an imbalance, where I think the press tends to focus on the violence and the and I wanted to look more at the business side of the operation. But I should I hasten to say that's not to discount the level of violence. Chapo Guzman has killed a lot of people. He's got a lot of blood on his hands, and so I imagine even with his Napoleonic stature, there is the implied threat of violence probably in most of his encounters.
Savvy, but also savage. I mean, the Zeta cartel is the one we think of for the big piles of bodies and beheaded heads and all the rest, but he's had Sinaloa do the same.
Yes, and it's funny, it's a contrast that you often hear. You know, there's an expression in Mexico, plato de plomo, the silver or the lead, the idea being that the cartels create a kind of an ultimatum. You can either take the bribe or take the bullet. And historically, the reputation of Sinaloa was that it was a very violent organization, but one that used violence rationally. It used violence in pursuit of business aims. And so they would generally go to the silver before the lead. They would bribe you rather than kill you. The Zetas are the opposite. They go right to the bullet.
But like any great hegemon, I guess, if that's what they are in drugs, you say they use violence to keep the credible threat right there, and they use it a lot. 50,000 dead since 2006. Patrick Redden-Keefe is with us. We're talking about Mexico's multi-billion-dollar illicit drug trade and El Chapo, the guy right at the heart of it, a narco ballad behind us right here, talking about him. El Chapo lives to enjoy, to traffic, to control, to kill. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Mexico's multi-billion-dollar illicit drug trade, most of it with the USA, and at the heart of it, Joaquin Guzman, a.k.a. El Chapo, chief of the Sinaloa cartel. Patrick Redden-Keefe has written about it for the New York Times. Big piece. It's up at our website, onpointradio.org, with all the detail right there. How'd he come up, Patrick?
Well, he started out in an organization called the Guadalajara Cartel during the 1980s, working for a guy who was known as the Godfather, El Padrone. And Chapo was sort of a capo in this organization. And one of the things that he was doing was negotiating directly with the Colombians. This kind of interesting thing happened where Mexican cartels had always sent marijuana and heroin across the border. They had grown it and produced it in Mexico and sent it across the border into the United States, going back decades. But in the 1980s, when the Colombian cocaine boom happened, the U.S. started cracking down on the Caribbean route. The Colombians, you remember, would be sending things into Miami via the Caribbean. And so you started getting U.S. planes and boats patrolling those waters. And there's an expression you hear in law enforcement occasionally, the balloon effect. The idea here is you squeeze one part of the balloon and the other part just bulges. And so what happened is that the Colombians started looking for an alternative route into the U.S. and they began moving cocaine through Mexico. So it's kind of a perverse sense in which the law enforcement's success of shutting down the Caribbean route actually begat the Mexican cartels that
and
we
put it right on our longest border there to the south.
Right, exactly, which in some ways is a much greater vulnerability. So Chapo really came of age when that transformation was happening. Originally, what would happen is that the Guadalajara cartel was acting basically as they were acting as couriers. Mm-hmm. They would be paid to fly drugs from Colombia into Mexico and then get them over the border.
And they flew lots. I mean, you're talking about half a dozen or a dozen or 16 flights a night sometimes.
It
was air traffic control.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Incredible.
And what happened is at a certain point, the Colombians started paying these Mexican couriers not in cash but in kind. They would actually pay them in cocaine. And that, I think, was a kind of a big hinge in terms of this development, because if you think about it from the perspective of, you know, you're this Mexican middleman, you've been getting paid to do a service, and suddenly you start getting paid in cocaine. At that point, you think, well, why am I just going to be a middleman? I'm going to go into business myself.
Let's move it.
Right. which they did. And that development coincided with Chapo's ascendancy. So his mentor ended up getting locked up in Mexico in 1989. And at that point, Chapo and a few associates hatched what would become the Sinaloa cartel, originally with just one route across the border in Arizona.
Hallmark of the Sinaloa cartel, you're right, the eclectic means, the many means they use to transport drugs. Give us a sense of the range there.
Well, it's funny. I talked to a federal prosecutor, and he said, you know, normally when you're thinking about ways to move drugs or ways to move anything, you're confined by your resources. But with Sinaloa, they're truly only confined by their imagination. Resources just aren't an issue. So if you can dream it up, they've done it.
Because there's so much cash flowing through their
hands. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. I mean, they move cocaine from Colombia into Mexico in a great variety of ways. But among them, I mean, they have submarines. Originally, they were these semi-submersibles, and then they ended up getting actually fully submersible submarines that are, in fact, kind of disposable. They'll only do one trip, and if they get caught by law enforcement, they can flip a switch. They can just sort of hit a lever and flood the submarine.
And their million-dollar submarine goes to the bottom, but who cares? The traffic goes on.
And who cares? I mean, I'll give you another example. The cartel owns its own 747s. Now, I would have to look it up. I don't know exactly what the price of a 747 is, but this is a vehicle that costs hundreds of millions of dollars.
What's the point of that? You can't land it on a jungle airstrip.
No, you can land it at the airport in Mexico City. Something I didn't get into in the piece, but there's been a great deal of corruption at that airport. And over the years, they have often flown drugs directly into the airport at Mexico City, and they've controlled different hangars there.
Commercial flights full of baggage, full of drugs, container ships, fishing vessels, speedboats, you name it. And even when the U.S. has put up the fence along big parts of the Mexican border now, you describe the Sinaloa cartel just bringing in the old-fashioned catapult.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an amazing moment. This guy, Mike Braun, who was the former chief of operations for the DEA, told me this with some wonderment. I mean, he said, you know, we got the best fence money can buy, this incredible high-tech fence, and go out there the next day and you see there's a catapult. They're flinging 100-pound bales of marijuana over the fence.
Beating the high-tech fence with a 2,500-year-old technology. And then there's the water faucet on the side of a cartel attorney at a house near the U.S. border in Mexico. And if you twisted that water faucet, what happened?
Right. So this was Chapo's really biggest innovation, was that in 1990, he had an architect design a tunnel for him. It's one of these ideas that, you know, it's so obvious in some ways. It's a wonder nobody had thought of it before. But Chapo had this idea, well, why not just go under the border? So he hired an architect to design this tunnel, and there was a hydraulic system where basically there was a hidden lever. It looked like a water faucet outside the door of one of the cartel attorneys, and you would twist that, and when you did, it would open a secret door underneath the pool table in this guy's billiards
big
room.
Heavy billiards table. It would move aside, and there's the entrance to the tunnel. The steps
and down
going
you
down.
Go right, and that was the first of the tunnels. That was 89-90, and in the years since, there have been over 100 tunnels discovered along the border. I mean, that was really a game changer.
They've got all kinds of ways of getting into the U.S. They're killing and bribing plenty of people to do that along the way. We'll look at the bribery. Once the drugs, I mean, and the death toll just enormous here. We'll look at what may come with that as well, as we've got a Mexican election coming up for president, and all three of the contenders talking about a shift in tactics there. But once the drugs come into the U.S., what happens with them? How do such big volumes get transported where, to whom? How's it work?
Well, this was one of the riddles for me. I mean, it's funny. The way I started doing this project in the first place is that I felt like there was this disconnect. I had loved the TV show The Wire, and I was very interested in the retail drug business in this country. And I wrote an article for another magazine back in the fall, which involved some drug gangs in a town north of New York City. And one of the questions I kept asking was, well, where do the drugs come from? Where do these guys get their supply? Mm-hmm. These guys who are selling small amounts of marijuana, heroin, cocaine on the street, who supplies them? And nobody really seemed to be able to tell me the answer. So what I wanted to do is try and connect that universe that we're familiar with from The Wire of retail drug distribution to these headlines we're reading about in Mexico, which is really the dominant source of supply. And it's a mysterious business. I mean, the part of what's interesting about it is that you might think that the cartels would be involved in the retail trade. Because if you look at the value of most of these drugs,
comes right at the end.
The value chain, it's mostly right at the end. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's where when you cut up a wholesale kilo of cocaine and break it down into retail doses, that's where the most value accrues. But actually, I found that the Sinaloa cartel, anyway, is not involved in retail distribution. What they do is they get the drugs over the border, and then they get them to these big hub cities where they have wholesalers. And these are cities like Chicago. Chicago is a huge kind of port for Sinaloa, if you like. And they will sell to these wholesalers. And the wholesalers then turn around and sell to smaller wholesalers, smaller drug dealers across the country.
And we're talking major freight movement here. I mean, from that tunnel, for example, and others, it would open into a kind of a warehouse near the border. They'd have trucks heading in and out of there. You described drug traffickers saying that the Sinaloa cartel could have the product across the border and on the streets of Los Angeles before the plane that delivered it from Colombia could get back to Colombia. It was that fast.
Yeah, I mean, this was the one of the most extraordinary things for me was just the scale of this and the efficiency of it. Another anecdote that really blew my mind is that, and this is true now, but it's been true going back 20 years. The Sinaloa cartel has smuggled large volumes of drugs on freight trains that cross the border. They pack them in Mexico. They cross the border. And the trains will actually go right up to Chicago or to Los Angeles. And there are rail spurs where the particular train cars that have the drugs in them will come off on the spur and go right into, it'll roll right into a cartel warehouse to unload.
Are the drugs in that case concealed? I mean, you described them packing, canning things disguised as jalapeno peppers out of Guatemala. But when they're on the freight train, are they just full of drugs, period?
No, they're disguised. And there will be phony bills of lading and what have you. They come up with very clever ways of concealing the drugs. But I think that Mexico's our third biggest trading partner. When you think about the sheer volume of trade going across the border in planes, trains, and automobiles, there are going to be ways for a crafty drug trafficking organization to filter into that their product.
Interestingly, one of their biggest challenges, because it's a cash business, you can't run it through the banks too easily, is getting the cash back to the drug lords. Such huge, just weighty volumes of cash.
Right, and cash is in some ways harder to move than cocaine. I sort of did a little bit of a taxonomy of the drugs and what's easy to move and what's hard. Marijuana is the hardest because it's so bulky. Well, cash is bulky. Cash is bulky too. Yeah, this is something that I think often goes missing in the debate in the United States, such as it is, about the Mexican drug trade. First of all, we have this tendency to think about a bad thing as only something that comes into our country and not possibly something that could leave. So first of all, we overlook the guns issue. We overlook the fact that all of this violence, or much of it, is happening with American guns that are making their way across the border. But we also overlook the money. We overlook the fact that on street corners across America, these drugs are changing hands, trading hands, in exchange for money. And the money is accumulated in these safe houses and then smuggled back. So the drug smugglers themselves don't think of themselves just as people who are in the business of exporting drugs to the United States. That's sort of half of the business for them. The other half is importing money from America.
Wow. But with plenty of death left behind all along the trail and plenty of grief left behind as well on both sides of the border. Patrick Radden-Keefe is with us. He's been reporting in depth on the huge drug trade out of Mexico into the United States, the Sinaloa cartel in particular, and its chief, El Chapo. Ruben is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Ruben, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, Ruben. What do you know?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm listening to the program, and it's a very interesting program today. Me being Hispanic, Mexican descendant.
Yeah.
I'm a truck driver, and I travel from California to New York and Connecticut.
Great.
Basically twice a month.
Great.
And I've been approached million times, from people that are basically involved in that kind of trade, and this is basically what they do. And in my trade, they approach you and ask you if you speak Spanish.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And if you do, then they engage in a conversation and ask you how you're doing. Then they'd proceed on the, would you like to make some easy money, you know.
What kind of money are they talking about, Ruben? Like how much to do what?
At that point, I try to disengage because, like I say, I've been driving for 23 years and I love my freedom. And I love my family, so I don't. At that point, I don't. You know, I don't want to get into details, but to the point that you guys are talking about, I think this is one way they approach for their logistics. You know, they try to talk to people who are in the business of truck driving, and if they succeed, then they talk about the price.
Sure. Hey, Ruben, have they ever tried to intimidate you? You know, is there any hint of threat or just money?
No, not here in the States. I would imagine if you do a truck driving job down in Mexico, they might. But up here, I doubt it, because if somebody approaches you with the wrong attitude, you know, they know you basically going to run to the police and say, you know what, this guy's.
Right. And there we'd be. Ruben, I really appreciate your firsthand report. You stay safe, and I appreciate that so much. Patrick Radden-Keefe in Washington, there you go. Ruben sort of right out on the transport lines, and immediately he's seen it. He's been approached, he says, a million times to help move it.
Yeah, and I got to say, that's not surprising to me. I mean, the trucking companies came up again and again in my research. And in some instances, these are dirty trucking companies, basically, where somebody affiliated with the cartel actually owns a trucking company. In other instances, it's guys like Ruben who are just doing their job and get approached by the cartels, who are kind of opportunistic. And if you think about it from the perspective of the cartel, you pay somebody to move something from point A to point B. They don't actually know all that much about your organization. Mm-hmm. So even if they were to go to authorities, there's less risk because it's compartmentalized.
And that's kind of down at the bottom of the food chain moving it. I mean, you trace the bribery from this, the single largest line item in a cartel's balance sheet, you say. I mean, very near the top. We're talking about in 08, Mexican President Calderon's, his own drug czar, was charged with accepting $450,000 per month from the cartels to do what?
Well, to pass, I mean, we don't know in that particular case, but I think that it varies, right? That at very low levels, you have these people, an army of people who are known as the Falcons, and these are basically just lookouts. They're people
all over the place.
Mm-hmm. They're all over the place. One of these DEA guys told me that there are towns in Mexico where every cab driver is on the payroll. And these are people who might get paid $50, $100 a month, literally just to pick up the cell phone if they see that there's an intensification of border checks, or there's a convoy of police, or they hear mm-hmm. something. And then that works its way up the food chain. You might have a police chief. There was a police official in Juarez who was working for the Sinaloa cartel, and I found his testimony, which is very, very interesting. And, you know, there they kind of lay off, or they may hit another cartel harder. And at the highest level, it's strategic intelligence. I mean, they're providing political cover.
Patrick Radden-Keefe, please stand by. Big piece, cocaine, it's called, but there's a lot more than that in it. You can see it at our website. It ran in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday. Another one of these narco ballads behind us here from Beto Quintanilla. Hey, they glamorize, but it's not pretty. A lot of death and grief in the trail of this drug trade. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Norte querida, ¿a cuántos ya te has llevado? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Mexico's multi-billion dollar illicit drug trade, most of it with the USA. And at the heart of it, Joaquin Guzman, a.k.a. El Chapo, shorty chief of the Sinaloa cartel. Patrick Radden-Keefe has written about him in incredible detail in a big piece. Headline, Cocaine, How the World's Most Powerful Drug Traffickers Run Their Business. But there's a lot more than cocaine here. You can read the whole thing at our website, onpointradio.org. It ran in the New York Times Sunday magazine. I mean, this is all over the place. Here, early February, 15 people in Albuquerque, New Mexico, indicted for running a drug distribution ring for Mexico's Sinaloa cartel. Here was DEA agent Keith Brown saying their roles were complex.
Was to receive drugs from the cartels in Mexico bring them north to Albuquerque, and then they distribute the drugs in Albuquerque and sometimes elsewhere, then collect the money, take their profit out of it, and then send the money they owe back south.
So much money that just getting the cash back south, it can't be a wire transfer, is a big deal in itself. Here in late March, Austin, Texas police made a series of busts, including lots of marijuana, 16 kilos of cocaine, 7 pounds of tar heroin. Here's Austin's assistant captain, Sean Mannix, talking to reporters at a press conference.
None of us in our memories can remember a seizure of heroin that large in the city of Austin. It's a tremendous amount of heroin. The flow of drugs is coming to us directly from our southern border, and Austin is being used as a hub for distribution.
Hubs all over. The money, the drugs flow in, the money flows right back. There's drug war south of the border, and it's bad. 50,000 dead since 2006. Liz in Columbia, South Carolina. Liz, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Patrick Radden-Keefe.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Really enjoying the program. I have a question, I guess, more about any kind of similarities or major differences between the Mexican cartel and Italian mafioso crime families. I noticed you used the word capo. I wonder, as far as organization or even paying tribute, if there's any major similarities or differences. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Liz. Patrick?
It's a great question. I mean, I should first of all say I shouldn't use the word capo. It's lazy of me, and in some ways they're not all that analogous. I think
why not?
Well, because at least in the case of Sinaloa, it is a it's diversified within the drug business, but it is a drug business. That is what it does.
The mafia did a lot of that eventually. We all know that they
did, but the mafia was also in the extortion business.
Okay.
I mean, they were involved in a wide range of different rackets. And it's funny because if you look at some of these newer cartels like the Zetas in Mexico, they in some respects are more typical of the old style mafia approach in that a lot of what they're doing is shaking people down. They're taxing everything that comes through. They've diversified into human trafficking, extortion, what have you. Sinaloa does a little bit of that, but generally they have kind of focused on their core competence, which is moving drugs. Organizationally, it's also both kind of bigger and smaller than the mafia. I mean, there's a when you talk to people and you say how many people work for the Sinaloa cartel, you get this wild disparity of estimates. So there's a guy who wrote a book last year about Chapo who estimates that he may have 150,000 people working for him. And then there's an academic here in Washington who's done some very good work on the cartels, a guy named John Bailey who I spoke with, who said he thinks it could be 150.
Yeah, and everything else kind of farmed out. I mean, one of the similarities I saw in your description, Patrick, was that as in any criminal syndicate maybe, the bosses fear one another. That's almost as big as their fear, and you can see why in Mexico with all the violence, but as their fear of authorities. And you describe this kind of blood cousins. I mean, all this intermarriage they do, like kings and queens of old marrying their kids off to other dynasties to try and have some peace or trust.
Right, exactly. So this is the Sinaloa cartel is sometimes known as the Alliance of Blood, because a lot of the members are related by marriage in one way or another. They're brothers-in-law or cousins by marriage, and one theory is that this is a hedge against distrust. I mean, the idea here is basically that there's not a lot of trust in the business. You want to do everything you can to hedge against somebody betraying you or killing you. And he's less likely to do so if your cousin's with his wife, and there will be hell to pay at home after he does.
You describe the wife or a wife? It's unclear to me because there's another wife I see in the news here lately.
Yes.
That the Treasury Department's going after. But a former beauty queen named Emma Coronel, just last year, giving birth to twins, a couple of baby girls in the USA. She's the wife of El Chapo and gave birth, went back to Mexico, and two new heiresses born, you say.
Right, exactly. And in just outside Los Angeles, and we knew, U.S. authorities knew, but there was nothing they could do. Coronel is apparently has her U.S. citizenship. So Chapo's daughters, by virtue of having been born here, are U.S. citizens as well. And there weren't any charges against Cornell. So Chapo, needless to say, did not cross the border to attend the birth.
Does the bribery extend to the United States? Does it extend? I mean, of course, we know from the reports it's there at the border. Border agents occasionally succumb to it. What about beyond that, a higher up?
I wasn't able to confirm cases of it happening higher up. And that certainly doesn't mean that it's not happening. But look, I think that there are all kinds of things that are not tantamount to a bribe that are more kind of structural problems in our country that feed this problem. Not the least of them being that we have 5,000 gun shops within 50 miles of the Mexican border.
We heard a lot about Fast and Furious and the Justice Department flow of guns there. But where do most of the guns come? Is the U.S. the arsenal, just our gun shops to arm up these super violent gangs?
Yes. There's some controversy over the precise fraction, but I don't think that there's any reasonable disagreement on the contention that most of the guns being smuggled into Mexico are coming from this country. It's very difficult to legally own a gun at all in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
There are guns coming from other places. In some instances, they're coming up through Central America. But the majority of the guns, I think it's pretty well established, are coming from the United States.
And you don't have to go to Mexico to run into them. You remind us of the hunter who was up in the north woods of Wisconsin, just stumbled on this huge irrigated marijuana grow site, a dozen Mexican farmers there, pot farmers with AK-47s, and boom. Heather in Augusta, Georgia, thanks for calling, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've actually been clean and sober for 2 years, so I feel comfortable talking about this now.
Good for you.
But I have, thank you. I've acted as a middleman in the drug trade at lower levels.
What were you moving and from where to where, Heather?
Well, in particular, when I was living near Charlotte, which is a major hub between New York City and Mexico, I was working at very low levels, but I was told many times that I wasn't allowed to go certain places, one or two levels above me when it was larger amounts of drugs.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because, I'm 24 now, but the reality is, as a young white female, I would have drawn suspicion going to these places.
Okay.
But I was the perfect person to work at lower levels so as not to draw suspicion. So I guess my what I'm curious about is just the dynamics of the identities of movers at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's...
Heather, what drugs were you carrying? Was it cocaine, heroin, what?
Well, it was mostly just marijuana, but okay. There was cocaine involved also.
Yeah. We're glad you're out of that, and we're glad you're off it, and we wish you very good luck. Patrick, what about it? You know, who moves up? Here was Heather, who couldn't move up the organization, and maybe good for her, but what about who moves up and, you know, runs what?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, and thank you, Heather, for sharing your own experience. There's a huge range, and remember what I said earlier about how the cartel involvement really doesn't push back. The Mexican cartel involvement, so far as I could find, didn't really push much below the wholesale level.
Mm-hmm.
So at the retail level, there's all kinds of gangs that are involved. Some of them with connections to prison gangs. It's a huge web of people. I hasten to say, and Heather's illustration is a good one, not all of them Mexican,
mm-hmm.
not remotely all of them Mexican.
Yep.
I spoke with a number of people who had worked in one way or another for the Sinaloa cartel, who were white Americans, and got involved. If you think about the scale of it, it would need to be that way. But Heather also raises a really good point, which is that it's incredibly compartmentalized. The way someone described it was that it's a chain of command where the person at the bottom of the chain never sees the person at the top. There was a guy whose testimony I found who had he was a mid-level guy working directly for the cartel in El Paso. And he was invited back to Culiacan, which is the kind of the base of the cartel in Sinaloa, for a meeting. And all of the high-level people in the cartel were going to be there. And he was excited. He thought he was going to maybe get to meet the boss. He was going to get to meet Chapo. Yeah. He got there, and all the other high-ranking guys were there, and they were all negotiating. And Chapo was nowhere in sight. And when they came to the end of their discussions, an emissary who had been sitting there listening to everything sort of trotted off and trotted across this this ranch where they were to a Hummer that was parked in the distance, surrounded by guys with bulletproof vests and machine guns. And they wound down the window of the Hummer, and this emissary reported everything. Chapo was right there, but he never stepped out of the vehicle. And this is in his home base with his own organization at a major summit.
A careful man and highly risk-averse a group of people, these drug bosses. Susan in Boston, thank you for calling, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm calling because I'm wondering how the cartel leaders feel about American drug laws. On one hand, most obviously, the drug lords need to worry about potential raids by police, but on the other hand, it's the fact that the drugs are illegal that allows this multi-billion-dollar monopoly to form. So I'm basically wondering if the drug lords generally feel like the drug laws benefit or hinder them.
Thank you, Susan, for that. And I have to say, thank you very much. And I have to say, Patrick, I mean, at our website and Facebook, I mean, it's just full of people asking about legalizing. Here, Michigan writes, says, remove prohibition, that is, laws against these drugs, and 80% of all crime will disappear almost instantly. Organized crime will cease to exist. This will become one of the great debates of the 21st century. What do you think? You've looked closely at it. If all or some of these drugs were legalized, what would we have? Just a big new corporation in Mexico with El Chapo as the, you know, public guy?
Well, it's an obvious question that needs to be raised. And it's interesting. I got different data points on this, some of them conflicting. I spoke with a cartel lawyer not too long ago, a guy who has represented a lot of these people. And I asked him, what do you think about legalization? This is an American guy. And he said, I hope it never happens. It'll be the worst thing for the business. But I also spoke with some people who've worked directly for the Sinaloa cartel moving marijuana. And I asked them about the medical marijuana law in California.
Law, yeah.
And these guys said, you know, it didn't we weren't really even aware of it. It didn't have a big impact on our business. So
compared to their overall volume, I guess they're saying.
Yes, I think, and I think that's it. I mean, it's tricky, right? Because as much as we could kind of game out what would happen if you legalized methamphetamine, cocaine, and heroin, I think the likelihood of any of those being politically viable in the near term is pretty minimal. Marijuana, it's much more likely. It's already happening. And then the question becomes, well, how much of an impact would that have on the cartel's bottom line? It's funny that the headline of the article was cocaine, but marijuana has always been a big part of the business. It's sometimes known
huge.
As the cash crop of
yeah.
the cartels.
Yeah.
So in theory, that would really have an impact. But we also know that they diversify, that they mix it up. I mean, in another reaction to U.S. Drug laws in the 1990s, when the U.S. started making it harder to produce methamphetamine in this country by passing regulations, at that point, Sinaloa saw that, and they said, look, here's a market opportunity for us. And it was at that point that they ramped up their meth business.
With container ships full of the ingredients for meth coming into Mexico. You know, we've got this presidential campaign in Mexico now. All three of the top contenders have promised a big shift in the country's drug war strategy. President Calderon has been very aggressive. It's meant really all-out war, practically. 50,000 dead, I think that qualifies. You say that traditionally Mexico's had a kind of live and let live. Might we go back to that just to bring the killing down? Let the drugs move. Let's not get so involved. Maybe the money goes in part to people in the government. Is that where you think we're headed?
Well, I mean, a lot of people do think we're headed there. The Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, which is the party that looks likely to win the presidency on July 1st, had a long history of a more accommodationist approach. And so there are many who think that they will return to that. I think that the cartels have gotten so out of hand that it'll be politically difficult for them to have anything that looks on its face too much like a total accommodation. But I do think that you'll see a downscaling. Because from the perspective of a lot of people in Mexico, if you think about it, they've lost 50,000 people. The flow of drugs has really actually not diminished all that much, though a bunch of the major cartel figures have been killed. And the primary consumer market for this is in the United States. I should say drug use is up in Mexico, but nothing like here. So the war has become more and more unpopular, and I think understandably so. And I do think that that means whoever wins in July, though it'll likely be the PRI, that we'll see a sort of a shift in tactics.
He's a big businessman, but in a way he's also a mass murderer. Lots of lives ruined here. Where do you think El Chapo is right now?
Well, we don't know. I mean, that you generally hear that he's on one of a number of in one of a number of hideouts, kind of up in the mountains in this very remote area. Though he was actually in Los Cabos several months ago and just narrowly escaped a government raid.
Where the G20 is meeting now? What, he went for dinner or something?
Right, exactly. I mean, he was there just shortly after Hillary Clinton had been there. In fact, this is a guy who has a fleet of Learjets. He is very mobile. One thing I found out in my research that hadn't been out there before is that even as a young man, he had traveled to Japan, to Hong Kong, all over Europe. He's moving. And so I don't know that we should necessarily conclude that he's completely kind of detached up there in the mountains. He may be moving around.
Well, maybe Learjets, but let's be very clear about it. This is a man whose business ruins lives, tens of thousands of people dead, a kind of gruesome killer. And nothing that we want to glorify right here in this business that has caused so much woe in Mexico and in this country. Just straight up grief and woe. Patrick Radden-Keefe, you inform us about it very well. We thank you for your reporting and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Radden-Keefe, his article is Cocaine, How the World's Most Powerful Drug Traffickers Run Their Business, New York Times Magazine. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.com. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.